Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than they're worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
When Julianne McShane wanted to report on how some of the most vulnerable women in the United States were dealing with the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, she knew exactly where she needed to go. Tulsa, Oklahoma. Oklahoma is where two realities collide. It is one of 16 states that have banned abortion almost entirely.
And it has some of the highest rates of intimate partner violence nationwide. I think people might not realize how significant and dangerous it is to be pregnant in the context of an abusive relationship. And abortion restrictions, obviously, just make that even more difficult.
Julianne wanted to quantify how difficult things were becoming for women in Oklahoma. So she met up with a domestic violence advocate named Heather Williams. Heather is not exactly a social justice warrior. She is a former cop. But she told Julianne this story about how abortion restrictions have upended her work. Back in the summer, she was called to a local hospital to counsel a woman who had requested a rape kit. Heather does this frequently. She holds a victim's hand. She tells them what's going to happen next.
And so this woman is in the hospital bed, and a standard part of the forensic exam is to give a pregnancy test. And so they give her the test and they inform her that the result is positive. And Heather said that she was frozen initially, and then she just broke down crying.
Was it clear when this woman got her pregnancy test result that she was pregnant by her abuser?
Yes.
Imagine yourself in Heather's shoes. Because of Oklahoma's ban, there is no abortion provider for Heather to recommend. Oklahoma also passed one of those vigilante laws a while back, the ones that allow strangers to sue you for aiding or abetting an abortion. It got tied up in court, but still, laying out medical options, it felt like a risk. Was this encounter a kind of revelation for Heather?
I think it forced her to confront what it meant to do this work in this new reality. I don't think she would consider herself an abortion rights advocate necessarily, but she sees the survivors that she works with, and she knows that it needs to be an option that's available to people.
You said when you wanted to talk about the intersection of domestic violence and abortion, you knew you had to go to Oklahoma. Is Oklahoma the only place where scenes like this are taking place, though?
No, it's happening all over the place. And advocates across the country are in this difficult position of not knowing what they can tell survivors, of fearing that if they do give them information, that they could be criminalized.
Sounds like there's just a ton of questions.
Yeah, and we probably won't have clear answers on what people, what advocates in these situations could or couldn't do, unfortunately, until there's an attempt to prosecute someone, probably.
Today on the show, how the new abortion landscape is causing chaos for domestic violence advocates and for victims. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Before talking about how the Dobbs decision is impacting domestic abuse survivors in this country, I asked Julianne McShane to lay some groundwork for me. At the top of the show, she called pregnancy dangerous for American women. So I asked her, why?
Homicide is actually a leading cause of death for pregnant people in the United States, which is probably pretty shocking to a lot of people. And researchers say that this is probably due to the prevalence of both firearms and intimate partner violence. And obviously, widespread access to firearms in this country is something that facilitates intimate partner violence. Many of the experts I talked to pointed out also that domestic violence tends to start or intensify during pregnancy.
It's a time of stress.
Right. Particularly if there's stress about money, if the pregnancy was unplanned, those are things that could drive someone who's abusive to become more abusive or to be abusive for the first time. Another really interesting element that some of the experts I talked to outlined is that there's sort of a paradox. They said that oftentimes, abusers will actually purposefully try to get someone pregnant to keep them under their control. But then once they become pregnant and the reality of a future child becomes more clear, abusers can actually get jealous. They can get jealous about the fact that this pregnancy, a future child, is going to take attention away from them. And so that can also be another factor.
Yeah, there's even this phrase, reproductive coercion, to sort of explain what's going on here.
Reproductive coercion basically describes or refers to any kinds of threats or violence against someone's reproductive health or decision-making capacity. That's how the National Domestic Violence Hotline describes it. So this could look like forcibly getting someone pregnant, refusing their access to birth control, sabotaging birth control during sex, also forcing someone to get an abortion, although evidence suggests that that's rare and that that's not a widespread issue.
Are there any numbers that show how the Dobbs decision has impacted any of these things, either the homicide rate for pregnant women or reproductive coercion?
There are. There's new data that is coming out. So the National Domestic Violence Hotline said that there was a 98% increase in reports of reproductive coercion the year after Dobbs compared to the year before. So they had more than 2,400 callers the year after Dobbs reporting experiencing some form of reproductive coercion compared to about 1,200 callers the year before that decision.
Were people referencing the law? Like saying, well, now that you can't get an abortion, here we are.
Some people were. Some of the callers, according to the conversation I had with one of the experts from the hotline, some of the callers were saying that their abusers were referencing the abortion ban in their state. And this is also broadly a tactic that experts expect to increase. Basically, when the state hands down these anti-abortion laws and these abortion restrictions, it can wind up enabling abusers because it suggests that the state has no interest in giving them access to abortion and supporting their reproductive autonomy. And so it's something that an abuser can also restrict. And it does sound like, from the anecdotes that I heard, sometimes this is what people are reporting.
What about the death rate for pregnant women? Is there any data when it comes to that?
There was a study that was published in February that found that actually under Roe, so even before Dobbs, even before things got as dire as they have become, pregnant and postpartum people in states with abortion restrictions had a 75% higher rate of homicide than those in states that protected abortion access. And all of those people weren't necessarily being killed by people that they were in intimate partner relationships with. But that study also found that pregnant people who died of homicide were more likely to die because of intimate partner violence than people who weren't pregnant and died of homicide.
I know that correlation doesn't equal causation, but this correlation seems very strong.
Right. And like I said, homicide is a leading cause of death for pregnant people in this country. So when you add an inability to control your reproductive life and to end a pregnancy that might be unplanned or unwanted by the abuser also, this is probably only going to get worse.
Would you call what's happening with abortion and domestic violence an unintended consequence of the Dobbs decision or something else?
You know, I would say that that's probably an accurate way to characterize it. I do think you could say it's an unintended consequence. And part of why I say that is because many of the arguments that anti-abortion lawmakers and other activists are making in their efforts to try to get the Supreme Court to ban medication abortion, which they'll discuss next week in the oral arguments that are slated for Tuesday, they tend to make the argument that abusers use abortion as a tool of abuse, that medication abortion, telehealth abortion facilitates domestic violence and harms survivors of domestic violence. But the reality is coerced abortions are overall quite rare, and it's far more common for abusers to forcibly get someone pregnant and keep someone pregnant as a way to keep them under their control, and that banning abortion access actually harms survivors more than anything.
You know, it's interesting talking to you about this issue of domestic violence and abortion. As you were talking, I remember the fact that there's some new data that's come out that shows that in the years since the Dobbs decision, the abortion rate has actually gone up in the United States. It's this interesting fact. It's gone up, I think, 10%. I wonder what you make of that, given what you're finding in terms of evidence that pregnancy is being used as a tool of abuse and how limited advocates are in terms of what they feel they can talk about.
That's a good question. I think that the fact that abortion is staying stable and increasing in places post-Dobbs just underscores the reality that it is still needed and that banning abortions does not stop people from getting them. I think that that statistic is also probably due in part to the spread of telehealth abortion. We also know that that is increasing since the FDA in 2021 began allowing these pills to be prescribed virtually and to be subsequently mailed. So experts in this space also talk about the significance of telehealth abortion for people in abusive relationships, because it can actually take away many of the barriers that people in abusive relationships may otherwise face to getting abortion care in person. So, for example, getting abortion pills mailed to your house means that You don't have to come up with a lie or figure out how to explain to an abusive partner why you need to travel, why you need to take time off work, why you need access to the car, why you need more money for gas or maybe even lodgings for an overnight stay somewhere. Self-managed abortion through abortion pills also looks like a miscarriage. So it does away with that level of scrutiny that you might get from an abuser.
And these scenarios Juliana's laying out, they're not just hypothetical.
Actually, I just talked with the physician behind Aid Access, which is one of the largest telehealth abortion providers. And she relayed to me an anecdote from someone who had ordered abortion pills from Aid Access and had an at-home medication abortion in the context of dealing with what seemed like some sort of abusive situation. And this person reached back out to Aid Access after and said, thank you so much for all of your help, and said that her abusive partner left after her quote-unquote miscarriage. So in this case, you know, that, I mean, there you have an example of someone who was able to pass off a self-managed abortion as a miscarriage. And it actually sounds like it contributed to ending that relationship.
Wow.
When we look at the friend of the court briefs that anti-abortion activists and lawmakers have filed before the Supreme Court, many of them are just totally blind to the context I just outlined. So there definitely is an understanding gap, willfully or not, in how many anti-abortion folks understand the relevance of reproductive coercion to people experiencing intimate partner violence.
When we come back, how abortion bans can intersect with laws around marriage and make even more abuse survivors less safe.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
There are some older laws that are being seen in a new light because of how they intersect with the Dobbs decision. For example, in the last few weeks, I've read a lot about this Missouri law that seems to prevent pregnant women from getting divorced. And I think it's not actually a ban. It's essentially how that's been interpreted by judges, though, which is that if you're pregnant, you need to tell the court you're pregnant, and it ends up delaying a decision there. There's a Democratic lawmaker who's trying to change the law there. Missouri is also a state that has completely outlawed abortion with no exceptions for rape and incest. What does all that mean? Like, when you hear about a law like that, how do you think about it, given all the reporting work that you've done?
I think it's just more evidence that these lawmakers do not understand the connection between the role that pregnancy can play in keeping someone in an abusive relationship and the importance of facilitating abortion access for them. I mean, we know that the right is also mounting an assault on no-fault divorce. My colleagues at Mother Jones have covered this. There are broadly more efforts among the right to make it more difficult for people to get divorced. So the fact that there are laws that are implicating pregnancy in this is not surprising. You know, if they really want to support survivors of intimate partner violence and reduce or prevent domestic violence, that's also going to require letting people end abusive marriages and letting people have access to abortion.
Yeah, I mean, you've spoken to lawmakers, including lawmakers who have some pretty right-wing beliefs. When you speak to them, do you think they see these connections you're talking about?
The one that I can talk about is a Republican state senator in Oklahoma who I called up when I was doing this reporting. His name is Daryl Weaver, and he has been a staunch advocate for victims of domestic violence in the state. He has introduced several bills, some of which have become law, that have harshened penalties for people who perpetrate domestic violence. Last year, he pushed a bill that became a law that made the first offense of domestic violence against a pregnant woman a felony instead of a misdemeanor, so it increased the jail time.
So he clearly wants to help, in his way, pregnant women who are dealing with abuse.
Right. But when I asked him about abortion, he actually made a comment that I think wound up being very illustrative. He said that abortion is a hot topic, and if we talk about it in conjunction with something like domestic violence, it could make it more difficult to pass legislation that aims to tackle domestic violence.
Yeah, he said if we clutter up these concepts, it's going to diminish what we want to do. It was interesting phrasing to me.
When I heard that, it really drove home to me that people like him that in certain ways, you know, have the best of intentions really don't understand the connection between these issues.
I wonder what you said to him in that moment, because from all of your reporting, I'm pretty sure you would think that it's not possible to separate out these conversations about domestic violence, pregnancy, abortion. So I'm curious if you said that to him or if he had a response to that.
I did respond actually by citing some of the research. He actually claimed that I was stretching the conclusions, and that does not totally surprise me because the anti-abortion side does not have a strong track record when it comes to putting together a coherent evidence base for their claims. Like I said, many of the anti-abortion politicians and activists who are arguing before the Supreme Court that they should ban medication abortion are citing studies that are not based in evidence about the dangers of medication abortion for people in abusive relationships.
You know, reading your reporting, I was struck by how complicated and messy all the characters were, which is always interesting because they're human. Like, you talked about how Heather Williams, that advocate, domestic violence advocate in Oklahoma who you spoke to, she's not especially pro-abortion. She's not in the streets, like, rallying for it. she just wanted to be able to talk to her clients about it and relay the information. What did someone like Heather Williams want a lawmaker like Daryl Weaver to know?
She actually, when I asked her, what do you want these anti-abortion lawmakers to know? She said that, you know, she's the one who winds up being in the hospital room, who has to comfort survivors like the one that she comforted last year, who found out in front of her that she was pregnant by an abuser. She's the one who has to tell them it's going to be okay, even if she actually doesn't know that it's going to be okay. And what she said to me was that she wishes that they were the ones that had to comfort them.
That the lawmakers had to.
The bigger point there is that they're not forced to confront the reality of these laws that they're passing. They're not seeing someone find out that, you know, the dreams that they had to further their education. They're not in the room seeing people's dreams dashed and their futures become even more uncertain than they already are because they have an unplanned pregnancy that they don't know if they can terminate. And that's what Heather wishes they had to confront.
Julian, I'm really grateful for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julianne McShane is a writer for Mother Jones. And that's the show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you soon.